Welcome to the Resilient Campus Podcast, amplifying the voices of college inclusion innovators. I'm your host, Sabby Labor, founder and CEO of Resilient Campus. Join me each week as I interview professionals on the front lines of campus and community movement building. For more information, please visit resilientcampus.com/podcast. This is episode number 5 of the Resilient Campus Podcast. Today we're speaking with Dr. John Paul, activist and media curator. Dr. John Paul is a writer, speaker, and social media curator. He has been featured on sites like The Root, Blavity, and most recently, FNix. He has worked with ATTN.com on topics related to the experiences of queer and trans people of color and led a TEDx in April on the topic of moving oneself from fear to freedom. Thanks so much for being with us today, Dr. John Paul.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
I know that bio is a very concise description of what you're involved with today, but tell us a little bit more about yourself.
One of the things that I like to frame is that a lot of the stuff that I do is based on this idea of speaking truth to power, right? And so I tend to base a lot of my work, a lot of my writing, a lot of my keynotes. I always think about my own personal experiences and how I frame those in relation to how I can help other people move forward in their own journey. Thinking a little bit about me or talking a little bit about me in my own journey, I remember being an undergrad and ultimately asking folks in different spaces, is this the experience that you're having, specifically other queer people of color? When we're talking about, you know, feeling silenced or moments where I was racialized or moments I felt marginalized and going through all of my educational experience, always asking that question, right? Is this just happening to me? This can't just be happening to me, right? I would oftentimes, I would look for spaces to be able to talk about those things and not really feel like I had a place or a platform to really talk about the things that happened to me or what I was going through. And so when I got the opportunity, someone had called me in and said, hey, you know, Dr. Higgins, I've read your, you know, dissertation work. I've been following you in terms of your educational journey. We would love for you to come and speak to some other queer students of color at our institution. The very first time that I had an opportunity to do that here in California, it really, really kind of launched me off onto this platform of basically being able to say, wait a second. There are a lot of queer people of color in this world who are having these issues and no one's talking about it. And why aren't we talking about these issues specifically in relation to race, sexism, patriarchy, white supremacy, you know, whatever the gamut might be. And I felt like that it was my calling and it was my time in that moment to be able to do that. And so ultimately a lot of the work that I do specifically, not only just in higher education, but also within other media spaces is really not necessarily trump myself as being the person who speaks up for queer people of color, but I really take a lot of time to focus on what are the issues and how are folks utilizing their privilege to rectify those issues and how can we have conversations that not only are fruitful and necessary, but how do we make them progressive? That's really what my whole entire platform is based on. Let's not just talk about the issue. Let's talk about finding a solution to those issues. So that's a little bit about me.
Beautiful, beautiful. And so which identities are most salient for you today?
The identities have been most salient for me in the last few weeks have really been both my Black and my queer identity, but also my identity of being poor. as folks may or may not know, I grew up in a very, very, very poor area of the Inland Empire. And so always kind of staying connected to this idea of needing to stay humble and also to reach back as I climb, but also this identity of what does poor oftentimes mean. And in a lot of ways, folks who come from very poor backgrounds tend to be silent. And so how can I utilize my voice, right, as someone who has a platform or is working to build a platform, as somebody who comes from the Black community in which Black queer people oftentimes are silent, and then also Black queer people are often silenced in the queer community, how can I ultimately utilize all of those elements of what I felt growing up and what I went through growing up to really now kind of zone into the work that I'm doing and how I can center that to be able to allow other folks who are not seen or folks who feel as if they're not seen, how I can ultimately center my experiences in all three of my intersections and really provide a space to have conversations around what it means to be Black and or, you know, queer, et cetera, et cetera. So
I love that you're referring to your calling in higher education and that your mission is to speak truth to power. And you also mentioned that there's a role that you have in reaching back as you climb. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that means for you in your practice?
Yeah. So I just came from Campus Pride, where I not only served as the curriculum director, but I also assisted too with providing a keynote. And when I talk about, you know, reaching back as I climb, it's this notion of knowing that there were a lot of students who knew who I was coming into that camp. A lot of students who either followed me on Twitter, or a lot of folks who have seen, you know, what other folks in media spaces have written about me and my journey. And a lot of folks who just ultimately said, we love you and we love what you stand for. And I think it's important for me to encourage other youth, specifically youth who are in activist work, to not only want to take care of themselves, but also think about ways that I can support them as they're moving forward in their journey. And the one thing that I talk very openly about is how there's almost kind of like this, I'm going to say it's a diverge, but it's two lanes, right? So there's this lane that there are a lot of folks who feel that activism means you're actually on the ground and you're actively putting yourself out there to create change, right? So meaning that you're organizing and you're getting people there in a space to say, yes, I'm going to push back this and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, right? You're actively putting work towards, you know, making a change. But I also am a believer that just as much as folks are actually on the ground doing this work, there are folks in social media spaces like myself who are making a change without actually being on the ground. I feel like my reach, knowing that I have close to 35,000 followers on Twitter, knowing that I have a very large following on Facebook, and that I have a lot of folks who have worked with me or have done things with me, this whole notion of reaching back as I climb is reminding folks that they are capable of doing the same thing that I'm doing and that I'm there to support them as they do it. I've had several folks in the last couple of weeks tell me, you know what, I'm going to go out and I'm going to reach my dream. I'm going to go out and go after my dreams because of something you tweeted or something that you posted. I see you're out there asking people to book you to do different things. So I'm going to follow that, right? And so having people, you know, tap me on the shoulder and say, how did you get the following on Twitter that you did? Or how did you get, you know, these people, you know, these articles for these big name folks that you've written for? How did you get them to pay attention to you? How did you get in those spaces? I'm ultimately providing folks kind of feedback on, not basically saying I'm going to keep everything at this dinner table for me. I am letting people know that the dinner table is big enough for all of us. And if folks want to come to the table and say, hey, I got a little bit of chicken, or hey, I have a little bit of seasoning I can add to your stuff, then hey, let's make a meal out of it and let's eat and let's grow together, right? And so I think that that's really big for me, is that I do notice that there are folks who have utilize their platforms to get ahead, to make money, to become very successful, and ultimately they become untouchable. Like you can't connect with them. They never tweet you back or they never talk back to you. I make it a point that anytime someone likes my status or anytime that someone comments on my status, that I go back in and that I actually say something about it. Or if someone tweets me, then make sure that I tweet them back and say, hey, thank you for that. Or thank you, you know, mailing them back. Thank you so much for following me. Thank you for your kind words. I always want to make sure people know that I'm never ahead of them. I'm just kind of blazing my own trail. And at the end of the day, I want them to follow me in doing the same thing for their own lives.
I do see that you have a really high touch philosophy towards it. So I really appreciate that about you, because it seems like you have a consistency around your practice on campus and off through social media.
Yeah, and it's a lot of work. But that's the one thing I want people to know. You know, I'm fortunate to have a partner who gets it, right? You know, my husband will sometimes make comments about me being on my phone, but sometimes I'll have to let him know, hey, look, this phone, this Twitter, my tweeting gets us, you know, pays us, gets us food in the house, right? So there are moments where my intermediate friends and family will say, you're always online. But I have utilized my online presence to really create work for myself and to create work for other people too. And so I think it is one of those things you do have to master, right? How much time you're putting in, how much work goes into, and also thinking about too, who do you respond to and who you don't. I get a lot of folks who respond very negatively to the work that I do and a lot of the things that I say. But at the end of the day, I've learned to be very cautious about responding back, because at the end of the day, I have a brand to protect, right? I have a name that I've set out to make sure that builds. And so every time I'm thinking about wanting to say something to rebuttal what someone else may have said to me, I think it's important for me to also acknowledge too that all of it's not always great as well.
Absolutely. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the inclusion work that you're doing today. Like, what are those top initiatives or top issues that you're pushing to the forefront regarding higher education inclusion issues?
This idea around how we talk about race and racism within higher education is necessary. And I think that that's something I've been centering a lot of my work around as I'm being booked and as I'm reaching out to other institutions to say, hey, bring me to your institution to talk with your students or to talk with your student groups. I think that that's the most common thing that comes up is the divide that queer students of color feel in relation to their other counterparts who are not, you know, QTPOC. And so knowing that there are a lot of queer people of color, specifically queer trans folks on campus who feel that they're even more pushed out of, quote unquote, the community, I feel like I've been utilizing a lot of my platform to talk about that. I'm actually editing a video as we speak. My video for this week on YouTube will be just talking a little bit about that. Why is it that me as a Black queer activist, I'm always talking about race and everything that I do? And I think at the end of the day, that's something that needs to be brought up. But even furthermore, I think something that I've really been able to do, and even, you know, there might be folks who don't agree with it, is ultimately calling out what white fragility looks like when we talk about systematic oppression around queer students of color in higher education, or even just queer students as a whole in higher education, right? We have a struggle with talking about, you know, what toxic masculinity looks like in different spaces. We're not talking about what patriarchy looks like. We're not talking about what supremacy and how supremacy shows up in the work that we do. I always have this thing that I always tell people in my keynotes that the bad is already here. And so at the end of the day, you have a responsibility to either face it and say, I'm going to take this quote unquote bad down, or you're going to just let it sit in the room and continue to fester and create more bad within the community. And so I think that that's what my calling has been, is to address what that bad looks like, because that bad has attacked me, right? That bad made it very difficult for me to excel in my undergrad experience. That bad probably kept me out of top tier, you know, master's programs. And that bad is what got my dissertation topic kicked back three times in my doctoral study, right? So I constantly am in this place of, I'm always thinking about, how do I address the topics that no one else wants to address? And being comfortable with the backlash that I get from that. I've had a lot of backlash in the last couple of weeks that I never thought I'd experience. But I do recognize that the more I do this work and the more I do speak my truth in relation to what that bad is, that it's my calling to be able to address what other issues are present in higher education and how I can become not only just someone who talks about it, but provide very, very, very cognitive solutions as to what higher ed professionals could be doing to make things better on their campus.
And so tell us a little bit about how you arrived to the work that you're doing today.
Yeah, arrived. Oh, Lord. Well, I think, you know, I don't really think I ever really did arrive. I knew, so it really comes back down to me being a child. I know growing up as a kid, my mom would always say, like, you know, your mouth is going to get you in trouble. And she would oftentimes, you know, say how I was very, very vocal. Ever since I was a kid, I've always been vocal about things that I saw that weren't fair. I even think about to like being in elementary school, right? I remember once this young woman, I remember her name. I remember everything about the situation. Someone was making fun of her, you know, for her hair. And I remember jumping in front of her and being like, hey, you need to knock that off. That's not cool. Right. So I knew from a very young age that I've always had kind of like an activist spirit. I remember there was a time where something happened in our classroom and me and my friend wrote a story about it and it got into the elementary newspaper. Right. I remember being in middle school, you know, constantly being the person who fought, even though I knew I was terrified and I got bullied a lot. I would often come to the, you know, the aid of other folks who I knew could protect themselves. And I got beat up a lot for sticking up for other people. And so I've always had kind of this activist nature about myself. You know, as the years have progressed, I fought a lot of battles in speaking openly and honestly and not sugarcoating the way that we talk about these problems, because that's what society often wants, right? They want to be comfortable in how we talk about the injustices that happen to people. And so after I got my doctoral degree, it was this notion of, okay, you can keep doing the work. You can go teach, you can go do X, Y, and Z, but you can do it safe, right? You can make your work safe. And I think how I've arrived to Dr. John Paul is by acknowledging and becoming comfortable with the idea that safety never saved anybody. Mm. And this idea that if we continue to keep talking about things in a safe context, that at the end of the day, we never get to the root of what the problem is. I'm a real big believer that when we start talking about this larger piece, right, how I arrived to this work and how I got here, is by acknowledging that we oftentimes, like, we acknowledge the symptoms, but we never acknowledge the problem. And I'm the person that's comfortable with acknowledging the problem. I'm going, hey, look, like, I see the Band-Aid. I see that you got all of the stuff to try to keep this problem here. But at the end of the day, we're still not acknowledging that the problem exists. And so I'm that person. And I think that that's how I've arrived here is people always saying, you know, oh my God, thank you so much for saying that because I wanted to say it, but I didn't know how. I spent a lot of time thinking about how I can frame things in a way that doesn't become me attacking someone, but me attacking the problem and asking the right questions about the problems that are present. And so I think that that's really what it comes down to is, you know, knowing one, I've always had an activist spirit, knowing I've always been that person who's always spoken up and who was always in trouble, right? I always got in trouble for speaking out about something. Someone said, oh, John always has something to say. But now I've learned, you know, being 32, having Dr. John Paul as my brand, having the following that I have, having the people who are reaching out to me to come speak at their institutions, I think people are now recognizing that what I have to say is or may be right. And I'm leaning into that. I really am starting to lean into the comfort of knowing that the work that I'm doing is really changing people's lives. And I think that that's how I got here.
Going back to having a doctorate degree, have you noticed any shift or have folks interacted with you differently as like a queer person of color with a doctorate degree? Have you noticed anything post-doctorate versus before you received it?
Wow. Yeah. You know, you struck a chord. I said, I wish that folks could see me and how I'm responding to that because I did, you know, when I just had a master's degree and I was walking into spaces and I was saying, this is not equitable or what we're doing here is problematic. People would just low key roll their eyes at me and just be like, okay, girl, have a nice day. You know, it was like no one ever really ever acknowledged what I had to say was right. But it wasn't until I actually got the degree and I was able to walk into meetings and go, here's the data, like here's the information, here's the research I did that proved that everything you're doing is problematic, that people actually started to listen. But I think there's something to be said around how we look at education and how we look at people of color who survive education. I don't just tell people that I have a degree to say I have a degree. My degree means a lot to me because I believe down to the core of my spirit that higher education was not built for me. There's nothing about higher education that says, come on in here, Dr. Higgins, you're going to succeed. There were all of these barriers that I had to navigate. There are all of these different people, specifically people who want to uphold white supremacy that are uncomfortable with someone like me succeeding. And so I've recognized even down till now that how that's played out in my life in different places, that it really comes down to the idea that I'm a very intelligent Black queer man. And there are a lot of people in this world who don't like that. And so now that I do have a doctorate degree and you ask the question, what is the shift, right? It's never in the middle. I never get people in the middle who just kindly go, oh, okay, whatever. I get people that are either, oh my God, Dr. Higgins is amazing. He knows what he's talking about. We love him. We want him to, we really want his voice in this space. Or I get the very, 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 very like lateral other side of the piece where I get people who are literally trying to shut me out of the conversation. And I think that it has to do with, again, what is knowledge, right? How do we think about knowledge? I always go back to this piece of why didn't we want slaves to read? Like, why didn't we want folks who, you know, were marginalized back in the early 1800s to know anything? Because knowledge is power. And so when you give someone knowledge, ultimately you're providing them a gateway to freedom. And I think that that's the bigger thing that I've had to deal with in my own trajectory of life. I've learned that the more I've learned, the more that I've been able to conceptualize what was happening to me, the more that I've read and the more that I've been able to actually put theory to practice or put words to what was actually happening to me, I found that people treat me differently because of that. And again, I either get a very, very great response, a critical acclaim, or I get people who look at me like, you know, I'm a problem or I'm problematic and that they don't want me in the space. What I find to be very interesting about this is that the folks who don't have a degree, how they respond to me, that to me has been what has changed tremendously. I find that I get a lot more resistance in conversations. No, I'm a doctor because I put in the work. I put in the 3 years that was asked of me to get this degree. But I find that there seems to be folks who tend to be very kind of shaky, or they tend to shake in their boots a little when I walk into a space and I introduce myself as doctor first. I don't know what that is. I don't know if it's just I'm a very confident person and I'm very confident in the knowledge that I have. But I do believe at the end of the day that having a doctorate degree for some reason in higher education makes you a lot more, it makes people a lot more attentive in relation to how they take in the message that you have, whether it be positive or negative. I don't know if that's my perception or if that's just me assuming from a marginalized mindset. But I do find it to be very much more that there are folks who tend to not want to listen to me or tend to challenge me a little bit more, especially when they don't have a degree or they have not been through a doctoral experience. The reason that folks tend to get very, very critical of me in spaces when they find out I have a doctoral degree is because of what education means to marginalized people. I am a true believer that education means freedom. And so if a person who is marginalized can conceptualize and can actively say what's happening to them, then that means that the person who is doing the oppressing has to be held accountable. And I think that is where that problem lies for a lot of folks, is that the more knowledge that a person has, the more aware they are of what's happening to them. And I think that that tends to be what, you know, again, going back and forth between, you know, how people respond to me or not, I think that that's where people have an issue with me having a doctoral degree, is that I am ultimately going to call out certain things in certain ways that I'm being treated because I have the knowledge to do so.
Thank you so much. The remaining questions have a lot to do with like sharing some resource and insight with our newer professionals, our graduate students, our folks that we know that the field is burning out and exhausting at really high rates. With that in mind, what is that one book or that one podcast or that resource that informs the way that you think about or that you approach your work in higher ed?
Two things that I think are really, really pivotal for a student affairs professional, knowing that I am now on the outside of student affairs and I'm working outside of it with a lot of folks who are in it. I'm able to see things with a bit more of a clear view. I would say the first thing is thinking about wellness, right? So thinking about how we talk about ourselves, how oftentimes student affairs professionals are not in the best headspace because of all of the responsibilities that they are given and a lot of the things that happen. I know for me, one of the podcasts that I've been using that has really helped me kind of navigate what wellness means for me as a person, and I always say this everywhere I go, is The Friend Zone. The Friend Zone, it is very Black-centered. It is very POC-centered. It is very much queer POC-centered because two of the folks who are on that podcast are queer people of color. But what I find to be very, very interesting / necessary in the conversations is that they take very real conversations that often queer people of color have, and they put a spin on it around what wellness means in relation to that conversation. So case in point, before I started my brand as Dr. John Paul, I was listening to one of their podcasts and they were talking about how systematically people of color oftentimes will negate their want and their wishes and their dreams because of the experiences that they've had throughout their lives that basically shoot their dreams down, right? And so I often think about that, how many times I was told that an idea that I had as a child was stupid, or thinking about how educators told me that a thought that I had didn't make sense, even down to writing, right? So I've been published close to almost 20 times in the last year, and how I talk very openly about how there was an educator in my undergrad experience who told me I was a terrible writer, and how that led to imposter syndrome and how I've had to undo imposter syndrome. They actually cover that in one of their shows. So I love that podcast because I think that even though it may not speak to everybody, specifically knowing that a lot of the topics relate to POC culture, I think it really does address something that's so real for a lot of marginalized people, specifically when we're talking about how we navigate our daily lives. Now, if you're talking about a book that I think is important for us to read, I'm currently getting ready to jump into Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay. I'm hoping to finish that book by the end of summer. But one of the other books that I did just finish reading was Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome by Dr. Joy DeGroy. And why I mentioned that book and why I think that book is so important and so salient, regardless if you identify as POC or not, that book really talks about what systematic oppression looks like. And it really puts a face to the way systematic oppression works. And it really provides this idea of how even prior to us being born, or looking, you know, what generational pain looks like, right? And so I really love that book, because at the end of the book, she basically says, you know, while it may seem like we're coming to an end of an era in relation to oppression, it's now starting to take a new face. And I think that book was just that book was published, I think, in 2015. So it's very interesting to see in the last 2 years what our world has become since that book has been published. So I find that book to be very, very important to the work that I do as a social justice advocate, because it really centers around what oppression looks like, and it gives a name to the way oppression works.
I know this is a big question. What's been that biggest lesson that you've learned in your professional life?
Ooh-wee. What lessons? I think the one big lesson, I know, right? There's been so many. You know, I talk about this very open and honestly with a lot of other student affairs professionals, and a lot of spaces I felt silenced, because, you know, again, I've come to learn and understand that higher education it's there to serve students, it's there to serve people, but at the end of the day, they have a name and they have an idea to protect, right? No institution wants their name to be dragged through the mud. And I think the one thing that I've definitely learned is to really, really ask myself, who am I and how does that connect to an organization or an institution? And to be comfortable with knowing that those identities don't line up. I think there are a lot of people in this world who are in jobs are doing work that does not necessarily feed them. And I am at a place in my life where I'm saying to myself, does a check to feed me mean more to me than me walking away from my job each day fed, if that makes sense? And mm-hmm. I think at the end of the day, that's the one thing I would say I've really learned in the last 10 years of being in this field, that I have watched this field really eat people up. But I've also watched this field really provide people the love and the support and the leverage that they need to survive. And so it is real easy for me to, you know, harp on all of the negatives, but I do feel like this is a field that oftentimes does bring out the best in people. But what I like to challenge people to think about, and then, again, this is something that I've learned, is to really think about how we sell ourselves to the institution and how much of ourselves are we giving to the institution and how much is the institution giving back to us. That's something that I've definitely learned, because at the end of the day, if your pot or if your, you know, what they call your invisible knapsack is empty and you feel like your institution and the people at the institution is just doing nothing but taking from you, you'll have nothing to give anybody else in this work. And so I'm just become very, very cognitive of what feeds me in this life now. I turned 32 on Saturday, and I'm just becoming very, very, very cognitive about where I'm putting my energy, who I'm giving my energy to, and what energy I'm putting out into the world. And I think that it's important for especially young student affairs professionals as they're coming into this field to be very mindful of their energy and where their energy is going and who has access to that energy, whether it be for the 8 hours that they're there or for the 24 hours that they exist. I just think it's important for folks to really check in with that.
Absolutely. What's one piece of guidance that you'd give to professionals that are doing equity and inclusion today in higher education?
Don't burn out. Don't feel like you have to be the person to do everything and to fix everything. I felt that way in a lot of the positions that I was in, specifically my last one. I was doing a lot for the LGBTQ community. I was doing a lot for the Black community. I was doing a lot for all marginalized communities. And it came to a point where I was literally ready to burn out, because I felt like everyone needed something from me and I had nothing to give. And so I think it's important for us for folks, you know, as they're moving through this field, as they're moving through their work, to find something and center on it and find folks who can leverage and support them in that. Because at the end of the day, overextending yourself, it doesn't serve anyone well. And so I've just become very, very cognitive as I give guidance out. It's how are you taking care of yourself in this work? How are you taking care of others in this work? And how are you making sure that whatever exchange that you're giving out is an equal exchange of you getting in?
What I've learned from you in a short period of time is that you enter these spaces with so much confidence and so much brilliance and so much honesty, you know, and it's even watching you in the past few weeks as you've gone through this situation, if we will, that, you know, I've watched you hold your head up high and really emphasize that the positivity is something that you're trying to put out there in the world. You know, we can hold those in dialectical framing, is that we can be positive and at the same time hold people accountable for participating and perpetuating and really trying to remain safe and comfortable in these systems of power, privilege, and oppression, right? And so I feel like what you've taught me, even in just the way that you embody how you've navigated this recent experience, is that you can hold those so gracefully. And I feel like you're really doing that for a lot of us. And so I'll speak, you know, individually for myself, I will say that I really respect all that you have done in the short period. I mean, we only met in March, and I just remember first meeting you in your session and just really being inspired by what you have accomplished, what you were doing in that moment, and where I know that you'll be headed in the future in terms of publishing even more and getting your word out to people that really need to hear that message. So I'm really grateful for you and how you embody this work.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. I will say it has been hard. It is hard to definitely stay not only one positive, but really, you know, there are moments where you do want to just burn everything down. But James Baldwin says that, right? To be woke means to live in a constant state of rage. And So it's this notion of my eyes are always open to what's happening to me, what's happening around me. And it's just this idea of how do I call people in to that versus how do I keep calling people out and not being able to not only just captivate but literally like actualize or create space to have conversation around you did this and this is problematic, or even allowing people the space to hold me accountable too, right? I think that's the one thing people see in me that I will say that I'm learning and I'm starting to kind of just become very comfortable with, is that I'm a constant learner, and I'm one of those people that's like, if you're going to check me, please do, because at the end of the day, I need that to become a better person, for me to level up. So I think at the end of the day, that's really what it is. You know, I tell people in everything that I do, as much as I don't believe that Anyanla fixes anybody's life, I do love the fact that she says, do your work. And I'm one of those people that out here in this world doing my own work to not only make this world better, but to also make myself better. So that way I'm not adding to the problems that this world has.
That's beautiful. So as we close out, what's the best way for folks to connect with you?
I'm going to always plug it because it's my home. Twitter is one of the best ways to connect with me. My handle is at Dr. John Paul, and I always tell people you have to spell it out. It's DocTorJonPaul. It is spelled just the way that it is on my website, which you can also check out at www.drjohnpaul.com. You can also connect with me on Facebook and Instagram. My Instagram tends to be just very personal, and it allows people just to kind of see that I'm human. So, you know, if you're looking for social justice stuff there, you probably won't get it. But I will tell people that my Twitter is very much a place where I tend to, again, speak a lot of truth to power. I tend to break things down in threads, and I tend to talk a lot about the injustices that I see in this world. Facebook, I tend to use more so for just letting people know where I am and what I'm doing and where I'm writing and things. So just kind of keep that in mind. You can follow me on all of those platforms, and I would love to connect with you on whatever ways you feel comfortable.
All right. So Dr. John Paul, thanks so much for being with us today. I want to close out with an inspirational quote to send you all back out into the world. Today's quote comes from Genesette Gutierrez. I will continue to always seek my truth and always challenge power. To all those listening in, thank you so much for all that you do. I truly appreciate you. Stay resilient.
Want to download a free copy of Roxane Gay's audiobook, Bad Feminist, as recommended by Dr. John Paul? Audible is offering a free 30-day trial where your first book download is absolutely free. You have over 180,000 titles to choose from. Try the service out for 30 days to see if it's the right fit for you. To start your free trial today, go to audibletrial.com/resilientcampus. Again, that's audibletrial.com/resilientcampus for your free audiobook.